through the top.
Environment Committee will come to order.
You think they'd pull the paper off?
They don't.
History of the Land, Episode 3.
The conversion of the natural landscape into a commercial one created prosperity across the state. But the toll on the land was evident and alarming. That era was a time when tremendous change was wrought on the natural landscape. Prairies were turned over, agricultural production, and the northern forest was clear cut. From the point of view of people who love the natural world, almost a dire situation, but someone had to put the brakes on.
You have to look at the whole continent to see it in its perspective, but it's in the upper Midwest where the frenzy of development and exploitation peaks and invites the response.
Thoughtful persons could see that the kind of resource use that had occurred in the previous 30 or 40 years could not be sustained.
Across Minnesota, people were beginning to look at the land in a different light. Men and women would call for reform in the way we used our natural resources.
This place is really important to us. We use this
launch our canoes when we go set net or fish. This river is usually produced a lot of rice, which is probably the reason that people have been living on this river for a long time.
By the 1890s, settlers and lumber barons were casting their eyes on this rich, forested land. In 1889, Ojibwe across northern Minnesota were forced to cede their reservation lands in exchange for individual allotments of 80 to 160 acres. Of the original half million acres the Ojibwe held, they would keep only a tiny fraction, just 11,000 acres. The allotment of the Leech Lake Reservation opened up more than 200,000 acres of virgin forest and would spark the first great public debate over the fate of Minnesota's North Woods. Lumbermen, settlers, and early reformers all had their own ideas about what to do with the former reservation land.
So they all had different agendas. They were all focused on the same pieces of real estate. And you had Christopher C. Andrews, who was the forestry commissioner and you might say the point man for forest conservation in Minnesota. At the time, Andrews was over 70 years old. Outspoken and vigorous.
C.C. Andrews was Minnesota's first commissioner of forests, appointed to his post in the wake of the Hinkley Fire. Andrews promoted a plan to create a forest reserve on the former Ojibwe land. Here, the new science of forestry could be practiced.
There is no other so available opportunity in our country for obtaining a considerable tract of original white pine forest for scientific management as here. C.C. Andrews, 1898.
Scientific forestry arose in reaction to unregulated timber cutting, and it was an attempt to find a middle ground between decimating our national forests through clear cutting them and preserving them from any use whatsoever.
C.C. Andrews would be joined by a new and powerful set of allies.
You had the General Federation Women's Club, who seized on this issue in part because they were a rising force politically. They did not have the right to vote or to hold office. One of the ways in which women across the country were asserting themselves was to demonstrate that they could be players in the political process. And so here in Minnesota, they seized on this particular issue.
This is an urgent and uncompromising note of warning. Lumbering operations and the devastating fires that follow in the wake of the destructive slashings have now approached the borders of the ceded Ojibwe reservations. State pride, health, and recreation demand that this opportunity shall not pass without action towards the creation of a permanent forest in Minnesota. The Courant, 1900.
While people in the Twin Cities pushed for the creation of a forest reserve, those who lived near the Northern Forest had other ideas. For the most part, people in northern Minnesota were still committed to farming the Cadover land.
The settlers in around Cass Lake, they had just moved in within the last decade. They were farming the Cadover land. They were utterly opposed to the idea of locking up this land. They wanted development.
The lumbermen and others rightly saw this as a resource. We could use to continue to feed lumber down to the sawmills in Minneapolis. But the people who wanted to see the area preserved said, well, if you cut down all the trees, we won't have anything left.
with settlers and lumbermen.
They had to placate local interests and assure them that settlers would not be thrown off their lands or that settlement development would come to a halt. They had to reassure lumbermen that there would be lumbering, although it would be conducted under sound forestry principles.
Logging companies were required to show uncharacteristic restraint. All slash had to be piled and burned. 5% of the trees were left uncut to reseed the forest in the wake of lumbering. And tall trees along shorelines were left for purposes of beauty and recreation. Though modest by today's standards, these limits were considered radical by the lumbermen of the day. With the support of President Theodore Roosevelt and his chief forester, Gifford Pinchot, legislation creating the Chippewa National Forest passed the U.S. Congress in 1902. The Chippewa National Forest was among the first of many managed forests in Minnesota, but it had other far-reaching significance. Its creation marked a shift in the way some people viewed the land.
The Chippewa is a place where we held back when we had every good reason to bulldoze further forward. And so it's almost symbolic where it sits there in the middle of Minnesota, in the middle of the continent. West Point, perhaps the point politically and economically and philosophically where we turn the tide. We began to think of these places and these communities in a different way.
And there really wasn't
turn of the 20th century, garbage and sewage were still an individual responsibility. Most often, refuse was dumped in an alley. And human waste accumulated in an outhouse behind a home. In poor neighborhoods like St. Paul's Sweet Hollow, sanitary conditions were abysmal. Outhouses were perched along Phelan Creek so that waste would flow directly out of the neighborhood. A major crisis in public health reached a peak at the turn of the century. Joined with the Minnesota Board of Health to call on one of the most prominent urban sanitation experts of the day, Carolyn Bartlett Crane. She came to Minnesota in the fall of 1911 to conduct a sanitary survey of the Twin Cities. Her lectures and reports on public health conditions were widely covered in the press.
We certainly should keep our city, that is to say, our common house, clean. The floor should be clean. The air should be clean. There should be sanitary collection and disposal of all the waste that inevitably accumulate wherever human beings have a home. Carolyn Bartlett Crane.
Reformers called for the expansion of a city-wide sewer system. More than 1,000 miles of sanitary sewers were laid in the next 20 years.
So the first sewage systems were built to pipe the human sewage directly to the river, untreated. And it just fell out of the pipes and was flushed away.
Dangerous waste was now carried away from homes and businesses. Public health improved dramatically. But by the early 1930s, the Twin Cities were home to nearly 1 million people.
It was a problem. It started to degrade the river. There was a story of one of the small reservoirs below here above the Ford Dam. The sewage had accumulated on the bottom in a big sludge mat. And on a hot day, it decomposed, created methane gas. The whole mat rose to the surface and started venting methane gas. Neighborhoods had to be evacuated from the riverbank.
Neighborhoods below South St. Paul were particularly hard hit. There, stockyards situated along the banks of the Mississippi River slaughtered tens of thousands of animals each week. All the remains were flushed directly into the river. A crisis was brewing. A series of water quality investigations was launched in the late 1920s and 30s.
In the summer of 1926, the U.S. Bureau of Fisheries did a fish survey along the entire length of the Mississippi from St. Paul, Minnesota, down to Red Wing. In the entire 40-mile length of river, they only found 3 fish.
Pollution exists. The water in the Mississippi is not safe to drink, not safe to swim in, not safe to eat the fish, and poses a danger to livestock who come in contact with the water. Minnesota State Board of Health, 1928. Soon called for the creation of a sewage treatment. Reaction-era spending made possible the construction of the largest such plant along the entire length of the Mississippi. For the first time in the city's history, sewage would be treated before it was dumped into the river.
As soon as the Metro plant was built and came online in 1938, the entire stretch of the Mississippi River above St. Paul improved very dramatically, very quickly.
By the late 1930s, the stretch of the Mississippi through the Twin Cities had been brought back from near extinction. It no longer posed a dire threat to human health. Yet in the decades to come, new challenges would face the Mississippi, and there would be continued calls for reform.
In this area, there are 250,000 acres of water. Down below is one of the last remaining wildernesses in the Middle West. One of the world's greatest timber regions, with virgin pine forests and a labyrinth of waterways. Although we have come by air, the region is accessible by automobile traveling on native pilots.
Minnesotans could flee the city and head up north. Among the more popular places to visit was the Superior National Forest in Minnesota's Arrowhead region. Here lay one of North America's greatest wild places. A timeless landscape of rugged granite-rimmed lakes, deep forests, and misty rivers called the Boundary Waters. It was Minnesota's last remaining wilderness, and the last of the state's great lumber barons, Edward Wellington Backus, had his eye on it.
Backus was a self-made man. He grew up on a farm near Red Wing, Minnesota. He started out as a bookkeeper. He was smart, very intelligent, and he was a visionary. He told a very charming story about snowshoeing north from Brainerd, Minnesota in the winter of 1898 with a timber cruiser, just the two of them. Below and the wolves were howling. He said, I came upon a wonderful sight of these great falls. And he recognized that his destiny right there.
The waterfall that so impressed him was Kuchiching Falls. Draining more than 14,000 square miles of the Rainy Lake watershed, it was a natural wonder. There was more water power here than at the Falls of St. Anthony.
He saw their beauty in the moonlight, we talked about that, but what he really saw was an enormous amount of water power.
In 1908, he completed construction of a dam that became the major source of electricity in the region. The falls also powered the fourth largest newsprint mill in the nation.
The appetite for paper in the early 20th century was immense. The appetite for electric power was also immense, and it was a growing industry.
The little village of International Falls was transformed into an industrial giant, and Edward Wellington Backus became a millionaire.
By the mid-1920s, he was said to be worth $100 million. He also had great political clout. especially within the Minnesota and National Republican parties. He had kept a little black book, they said, in which he kept a record of fairly heavy contributions to both sides of the aisle.
Backus had a great deal of influence. He also looked the part of the 19th century lumber baron with his silver hair and mellifluous voice and his rather arrogant attitude toward everything, which was tempered in part by a disarming charm.
By the 1920s, Edward Backus controlled the natural resources of an area the size of New Hampshire, Vermont, and Massachusetts combined. But he wanted more power for his mills, more water flowing over his dam at International Falls, and even greater control of the Boundary Waters. But he was about to meet his match.
Harness and regulate the waters in that watershed so that he would have
many summers assessing and photographing the environmental consequences. He noted damaged shorelines and timber stands, as well as the way flooding hurt local farmers and resort owners. Now, Backus was proposing a series of dams that would affect the entire watershed. Waterfalls would be replaced with concrete dams. Many large lakes would be raised from 12 to 18 feet, and thousands of islands would be submerged. Backus enthusiastically promoted his scheme.
But the benefits to the people of Canada and the United States may be briefly summarized. Navigation will be improved, the scenic beauty of the streams and lakes will be enhanced, and they will become more accessible to tourists. Uniform water levels will improve fish, fowl, and game. New wealth will be created. Any lands affected by the waters of Rainy Lake are not of value enough to consider. Edward Wellington Backus.
Because the region is largely in a state of nature, Mr. Backus assumes that it's valueless. But that is exactly what constitutes its value to the public. Ernest Oberholzer. Many others would come to share Oberholzer's fears for the boundary waters. Sewell Ting was a young, up-and-coming Wall Street attorney and frequent visitor to Mallard Island. He often canoed with Oberholzer and shared his love for the region. Mr. Ting was as much disturbed as anybody by the prospect of what was going to happen to these wonderful canoe waters. "We were very much alarmed," Mr. Ting had said. "We're just like a lot of farmers with pitchforks against a man with a Gatling gun." Ting and Oberholzer were part of the generation that had lived through and been shaped by World War I.
Those who survived the war came home, and for the first time they had had a taste of the outdoor life, and they liked it. And many of these men have also been taking canoe trips and outings in the Superior Forest, and realized that if Backus succeeded, the places that they had also recently enjoyed would be gone.
Wilderness becomes a resource. People begin to think of it as a resource because it's disappearing, just as the white pine had disappeared, just as game populations had disappeared. So, in fact, were large tracts of undeveloped land beginning to disappear.
By the late 1920s, there was mounting public pressure to protect the Boundary Waters region. Oberholzer and his associates were joined by major conservation groups like the Isaac Walton League and the Federation of Women's Clubs. In 1927, a new conservation organization was formed. The Quetico's Superior Council was created to fight Backus and the proposed dams. Ernest Oberholzer was called on to spearhead the fight.
And so with a fair amount of reluctance, Oberholzer left Rainy Lake and moved down to an apartment in Minneapolis to make speeches, to raise money, to contact the influential people, write letters, which he did. And he was charming, he was personable, he was brilliant when it came to networking people together.
Ernest Oberholzer and the Quetico Superior Council soon realized that the only way to completely stop Edward Backus and his plans to flood the region was through federal legislation. They would have to take the fight over the boundary waters to the floor of the United States Congress.
1920s, he and others helped to shepherd a bill called the Shipstead-Nolan Bill in the United States Congress. It was a very dicey struggle to get it through. There were all kinds of forces brought to bear to keep this from happening, especially promoted by Edward Wellington Backus. And sometimes when they met in the halls of power, why, he would say condescending things to Over. He would say, "Are you still climbing the beanstalk?" Which is kind of strange, because when we know the outcome of their circumstances, that in fact he was the giant that fell.
Despite an enormous amount of time and money spent lobbying in Washington, Edward Backus lost his fight on the floor of Congress. The Shipstead-Nolan Act passed in the waning days of the 1930 session. There would be no flooding of shorelines on public lands in a 4,000 square mile region of boundary waters. And forests on lakes and rivers would be preserved throughout the area. The boundary waters had been saved from destruction. The long battle to preserve the region as a wilderness could now begin.
I believe John Muir was the first person to talk about wilderness as a university. And over Adam, and I think that was quite wonderful, he said, it's a university where the other half of wisdom is taught, that greater part of wisdom that can't be taught indoors.
Such lands, wrote Overholzer, would link us with the primeval past, promising sanctuary for all time to unborn multitudes. The deepening of the Great Depression and the fight to dam the boundary waters destroyed Edward Backus's empire. Yet he had played a key role in the effort to protect the region.
If Edward Backus hadn't had his overweening pride in this enormously ambitious plan, sometimes described as the greatest water power plan in the United States history, if that hadn't happened, the sort of forces of opposition would have emerged. And so, in a way, Backus is responsible for the energy of preservation. And Over recognized this when Backus died alone in his hotel room in New York City.
I heard of it suddenly. 2 or 3 telephoned me, joyously. It didn't affect me that way at all. I felt the other way. Of course, I said jokingly to people, well, now we have lost our best friend, because we hadn't got anyone to quarrel with. But I will miss Edward Backus.
One of the most harassed by the killing pairs.
hosts of gray marauders, which each year descend from the wilds of Ontario. Sigurd Olsen, The Poison Trail. Minnesota's diverse habitats had once been home to an abundance of wildlife. Yet in the decades following European settlement, wildlife numbers plummeted. Beginning in the 1920s, concerns about Minnesota's game populations would lead to new efforts in conservation. Like most conservationists at the time, Sigurd Olsen was certain that killing predators would help restore big game to the state's north woods.
Predators were thought of as the really bad kid on the block. And the state had bounties, predator bounties, way back into the 1850s and 1860s. And the state conservation department paid bounties on everything from timberwolves and mountain lions and badgers and pocket gophers and rattlesnakes. And all of those bounties persisted for a while.
State game wardens were given license to kill all the predators they could, and some hunters made their living collecting bounties. In Russo County, clubs were formed to kill wolves. In one winter alone, more than 800 wolves were trapped, poisoned, or shot. Predator control was not the only effort made to restore game populations. Sportsmen and conservationists tried numerous other strategies.
There are all these restrictive approaches that are taken. We will enact stricter game laws, bag limits and such things. We will wipe out predators that will allow game species to proliferate. We will create these refuges that will give them a safe haven so that hunters can harvest the overflow. Well, those are all restrictive and negative in their approaches.
None of the early conservation efforts significantly improved wildlife numbers. All failed to account for profound changes in the land.
Well, wildlife populations really changed in the late 1800s and the early to mid-1900s, basically due to the change in habitat.
As forests were cut and prairies plowed, habitat was destroyed and populations continued to plummet. But one landscape had remained relatively untouched. The vast network of shallow lakes, marshes, and potholes in the western third of the state.
These potholes, they're actually like bowls of soup or something. They're filled with all sorts of little organisms, invertebrates, snails, worms, just the things that ducks love to eat.
Not much further here, but I don't go with the duck gun and the duck's in the boat. They're just like many ducks. Mallards, canvasbacks, redheads, big boys all. The limit. business owner, several times a day, every 6 to 11.
Even as the state promoted the glories of duck hunting, Minnesota's wetlands were in jeopardy. In the late teens and early 20s, booming agricultural markets encouraged farmers to expand fields. In western Minnesota, the last tracts of potential farmland were prairie potholes and wetlands. A drainage craze swept through the region with devastating effect as farmers drained wetlands to create new fields of corn and wheat.
A report that timber wolves kill a deer a week, it is accepted as fact. And immediately, any program to eliminate this menace to wildlife is heartily endorsed. Because there has been no attempt to disprove these theories, the campaigns of extermination go unchecked. Cigarettes.
He stepped back from looking at the wolf as a pure bad guy, and trying to think of, okay, this is one piece of this whole system here, and how does it fit in?
Also, Leopold was making the same intellectual journey as Sigurd Olsen.
Leopold's view on predators shifts 180 degrees. In the teens in 1920, thinking, as did most people of his generation, that the only good predator is a dead predator. By the early 1930s, he's almost saying that as conservationists, we need to be conserving the entirety of the community of life. The predators on down to the plants, down to the rocks and soils, because they are all interrelated. What happens to one level will happen and echo through the rest of the system.
In an essay called Thinking Like a Mountain, Leopold described the change. He recalled shooting a wolf and approaching the dying animal.
seeing the green fire dying, I sense that neither the wolf nor the mountain agree with such a view. Out of Leopold.
Okay, discussion from committee. Any comments before we move on? The next item on the agenda.
Dibble.
Oh, I'm sorry, is Senator Dibble.
I just thought I'd mention that. I've been walking around this place. I didn't notice until a few months ago that Sigels and Spuffs is right outside the door here to the right.
Good observation. Next item on the agenda is discussion of invasive species. We'll hear from the DNR.
Chairman.
Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Steve Hirsch. I'm with DNR Ecological Services, and we've got a PowerPoint presentation that we're getting to set up here. I guess it's ready to go. Also, you should be getting a copy of an annual report summary on our invasive species program and a copy of the PowerPoint presentation as well. For afterwards, we have a copy of our full invasive species report that we can make available So that I'll get started. What I'd like to do is just provide a brief overview of our invasive species program and some of the issues that we're grappling with. Hopefully leave enough time for questions. I think everybody knows that invasive species has become one of the major conservation issues of our day, and there's some overarching reasons for this, and they are the global economy that we have, and also the mobility of our society. And these are things that have happened in relatively recent times, and the effects in terms of the number of invasive species we're seeing in our state is directly related to these two issues. And because of these, the overarching nature of these issues and the nature of invasive species themselves, there's no easy fixes for some of the problems that I'm going to overview and talk about today. There are a lot of species that are non-native that can make their way into the state, but the thing that distinguishes a species and gives it the name an invasive species is the fact that they can outcompete native species that we have. They usually have some, or they always have some sort of characteristic that gives them a competitive edge over the native species. A lot of times it's a lack of the natural control that might have existed in their native range. But in any event, this competitive edge that they have over our native species ends up causing environmental and economic problems. And we have issues with invasive species of plants, both aquatic and terrestrial. Terrestrial plants are becoming a larger issue all the time. We have issues with invasive species of animals and also with invasive pathogens. Some of you may have heard about things like largemouth bass virus, which are now being found in some of our lakes. And these pathogens have the potential to impact wild fish populations under certain conditions. If you go back to, we chose 1987, at that time the whole issue of invasive species really wasn't in the forefront. There was no state program, really no laws directed at invasive species, no budget for any invasive species program. We didn't have as many aquatic invasive species as we do now, but we did have some. And actually, some of these issues have been with us for a long time. An example I would use would be the sea lamprey, which actually decimated lake trout populations in the Great Lakes in the middle of the last century. And so even though we see more of these species today, I think it's worth noting that this is not necessarily a new problem, and it's one that we have been dealing with for some time. Then in 1987, we began sort of the infancy of invasive species programs. We started a program to deal with purple loosestrife in 1987, which is a wetland plant that has the ability to take over and dominate other native wetland plants. And then in 1989, we started a program to address Eurasian water milfoil, which had been found in Lake Minnetonka a couple years before that. And then in 1991, a task force on invasive species convened and ended up recommending that a state program be established, and the legislature followed through with that and did establish a program. And if you fast forward to what that looks like today, we've got a program, we've got a comprehensive set of state laws that deal with invasive species, we've got a budget of about $2 million, and we also have a Minnesota Invasive Species Council. But as you all know, we also have, in spite of all these efforts, a growing number of invasive species in the state. I wanted to mention a couple of things just about the differing authorities for management of invasive species. There's actually two state agencies that have a significant responsibility when it comes to invasive species management. The Minnesota Department of Agriculture has responsibility over plant pests, and they focus on terrestrial invasive pests that haven't been established yet in Minnesota, and then also terrestrial invasive plants. On the other hand, the DNR has responsibility for aquatic invasive species, invasive wild animals, terrestrial invasive plants that we have on DNR lands, and then forest pests that have become established in the state. So that just gives you an idea of how there is some overlap, but how the responsibilities differ between the two agencies.
So does the Department of Agriculture have responsibility over invasive pests that are established in Minnesota, or aren't there any?
Mr. Chairman, once the invasive pests become established, then that responsibility shifts to, for example, the DNR to manage those pests on state lands.
What about non-state lands?
Mr. Chairman, we've got somebody from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture here that would probably be better able to answer the question.
Welcome. Please introduce yourself.
Members of the committee, my name is Geir Friesa. I'm the director of the Plant Protection Division with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And in response to your question, yes, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture would have responsibility for those invasive pests on public lands, and part of that is through the noxious weed statutes and also under the plant protection statutes.
Well, the PowerPoint says that agriculture has responsibility over terrestrial invasive plants and terrestrial invasive pests. Are those two different things?
Generally, we distinguish the base of terrestrial plants as being the noxious weeds, and we usually put that under the noxious weed program. The department has some oversight for that statute, and then the enforcement is generally at the county level.
And is that on public lands only or private areas as well?
Mr. Chair, that would be for both.
Okay. But it doesn't have anything to do with invasive pests on both, only public.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if I'm understanding. When we say invasive pests, you're saying exclusive other than plants?
Correct.
Yes, the department, the way we've always divided it between DNR is DNR has the lead authority on state lands, and then other lands the Department of Agriculture would have take a lead authority.
On pests as well as plants.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Sorry for interrupting. Go ahead.
And just the next point I wanted to make is just it's important for all levels of government to get involved. I think a good example of that is, I'm sure many of you have been aware of the issues with ballast water, ocean-going vessels, and this is one of the major vectors for introductions of new invasive species. And this is an example of an issue where federal agencies really need to step in and provide some consistency and oversight in terms of how we address this issue. So getting to the actual programs themselves, or the program itself, I should say, there's three basic approaches to dealing that we describe in terms of dealing with the invasive species issues. One is to prevent introductions of new species that are coming into the state. The second is to prevent the spread of invasive species once they get in the state, to prevent the spread within the state. And then third is to manage populations of invasive species that have become established in the state to try to reduce their impacts. And I'll just give a little bit more information about each of these strategies. In terms of preventing new introductions into the state, this is an extremely important part of the program. And one of the things that we do initially is risk assessment. Here we're doing two things. We're trying to determine which pathways have the highest risk of bringing new invasive species into the state, and then of the species that are on the horizon, which of those has the potential to be most damaging in the state? In other words, which of them are going to adapt the best to our climatic and environmental conditions and potentially affect our native species? Then we have the second phase of this, or the second tier of this, is regulation and enforcement of regulations. And then finally, education. And education it almost sounds cliche to say it, but it's an extremely important part of all natural resource programs, but it's especially true for invasive species because we're really talking about getting people to understand what's out there and the need to change some longstanding behaviors that people are very used to doing in order to be able to minimize the extent that we get new invasive species in the state and then to minimize the spread from of species once they are in the state. And terms of preventing spread within the state, the first thing we do is we try to identify new infestations as quickly as we can. We've got a regulatory system in place where we designate lakes that become infested with invasive species so that people know about it. And we try to verify those reports and designate those lakes as quickly as we can. There are situations where we try to respond quickly to new infestations. Sometimes a very rapid response is something that we need to do, such as when we see mute swans on a lake. We've been going out immediately and trying to capture those. Other times, a new infestation, while it may seem like a rapid response is warranted, there isn't a whole lot that we can do. A recent example is finding New Zealand mud snails in the Duluth Harbor. It's a situation where there really isn't a whole lot that can be done. So there's no rapid response that is done for something like that. But in general, we do need to be able to respond rapidly when the situation calls for it. So that's an important part of this phase of the program, too.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not aware what's meant by removing mute swans. Are mute swans an invasive species?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, yes.
Never heard of that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Vickerman.
Tell me why. I know a lot of people love those swans. Why would we?
Mute swans?
Why would you want to destroy them?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Vickerman, it's the issue we've got with them is potential for impacts on native waterfowl and impacts to habitat. I've got Jay Rendell here. He actually knows a little bit more about that if you'd like him to.
Well, Mr. Chair, I want to bring this up because I've been reading different articles and not everybody's happy with your DNR's idea of getting rid of mute swans. They like to feed them, to take care of them.
Never heard of them.
Give me a good reason.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'm Jay Rendell. I'm the Invasive Species Program Coordinator at the DNR. And the issue with mute swans is that these are very aggressive birds. They scare native birds away from different areas. They also can attack people even in canoes and other situations. The states out east have populations in the thousands of these waterfowl, and what they do is they rip up the vegetation, the submersed vegetation that's part of the ecosystem that's very important. They can tear up 20 pounds per day, just one mute swan can. So they're very, very damaging to the habitat. They also scare away loons, and we have many calls from the public asking us to come remove mute swans from the lakes where they exist, because they no longer have loons nesting on their lakes. And there are other impacts as well. So what we've been trying to do in Minnesota is to remove the very few that we have and keep populations from establishing here and causing larger problems in the future. And many of the eastern states are managing these swans. Wisconsin is becoming much more aggressive. They have several hundred swans in Wisconsin versus the thousands in the East Coast states. And as of right now, we only have a few that we find each year in Minnesota.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, could we clip their wings and tether them into large patches of Eurasian milfoil and see if they can...
Actually, Senator Olson, they don't like to eat Eurasian water milfoil.
Oh,
they're selective in what they eat, and so of that 20 pounds of vegetation they rip up, they might eat 10 pounds of the good stuff that the other waterfowl like. So,
Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Rendell, what is the status of the mute swans? Are they a migratory waterfowl or protected by
Senator Fredrickson, the mute swan is an unprotected species in Minnesota, and it is unprotected in the nation. At one time, there were court cases that said it fell under the Federal Migratory Bird Act, and that has now been clarified by the courts and the Fish and Wildlife Service. They have listed all of the non-native species of birds that do not fall under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. So it's been clarified that these are not migratory waterfowl.
Follow up?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Rendell, so would it be legal to control them by taking them with a firearm?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fredrickson, anyone can take a mute swan anytime they would like in the state of Minnesota.
That's a little
now, When we've removed them from the wild, we've used a variety of means, and of course, if it's in the Twin Cities metro area, we have to be very careful with how that is done because you can't use firearms here. So,
where did they come from, and where do they generally populate in Minnesota?
How the ones got to Minnesota, I can't tell you exactly, but some of them are likely to be spreading from Wisconsin into our state. Some may have been purchased and used ineffectively to try and keep Canada geese from entering an area that, say, on a golf course, they may put mute swans in a pond thinking that they would keep Canada geese from entering the area, but that does not work. So they have been sold and purchased in various places, and probably more likely, though, is just this whole population is spreading from the East Coast to the Great Lakes and then into our states. I think one estimate I heard was that the population is increasing in the Great Lakes states 10 to 20% a year.
Senator Dibble.
They were originally from Europe, and that the first ones that were brought to the East Coast were penned, and in a hurricane or some major storm, they escaped and started the populations in Chesapeake Bay.
So these are the swans we don't think of, the white swans coming around the pond.
Well, there are two native species of swans, the trumpeter swan that we're trying to restore those populations, and then the tundra or whistling swan. Those are the native species. This is a non-native, and they're differentiated by the beaks. The mute swans have an orange beak with a black hump on it, where the native swans have all black beaks.
That's where I was going with my question. I think people think that if we get rid of these swans, we're getting rid of all swans. There are other swans native that we're also trying to protect.
I take it they don't make a sound?
Correct.
Senator Parasol.
For Mr. Rendell, could you give us an idea of whether they're anywhere in the state or are they kind of popular? I wouldn't know if you offered up to me.
They've been found in the East Metro area on several lakes. They've been on the Mississippi River down toward Winona occasionally, and some of the western prairie pothole areas they've shown up. So it's scattered, but mostly the Twin Cities area is where they're reproducing.
Why don't you stay at the table? We might have other questions on other species, Senator Parasol.
Just follow up, would that mean that there's kind of become a resident population is a decent many of the larger communities are not necessarily migratory than the resident?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first part of the question.
Would that mean that the swans then have become a native resident population as some of the geese have?
Well, that's what we've tried to avoid. In some of the lakes in the Twin Cities area, they have reproduced, and so those are where we've kept. You know, there were two in one year and then seven or so the next year, so we've removed those populations.
Yeah. Mr. Hirsch, would you like to continue?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just in the last part of preventing the spread, I wanted to mention the watercraft inspection program that we have. We do have a very large program that checks boaters as they leave lakes, both infested and uninfested lakes, and recreational boaters are one of the major vectors for spreading aquatic invasive species around the state. So this has become a big program and has had some success in informing people about these issues. Then just the third part of the program deals with management of species that we do have. We're trying to provide technical assistance. We're trying to look for better management tools, which involves research. We have grants, and it's a grant program that we've actually increased the last couple of years to give money to local groups to treat Eurasian water milfoil and curly leaf pondweed. It'll be about a $350,000 program this year, up from about $100,000 a couple of years ago. And the challenges with management are we have to, of course, obviously find techniques that are effective, and we have to also avoid the possibility of doing more harm than good. There are at times potential treatments that fall into that category that I would call cure is worse than the disease, so we have to be careful of those things as well. Just some examples of management.
Question on that, Senator Olson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you whisked by the inspection program. You said that it had been quite successful. How do you measure the success of the inspection program?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, one of the ways that we've done that is through surveys where we ask questions, and we ask them. The first time was 1990s sometime, I think, and then we followed up about 5 or 6 years later. And just to give you an example, one of the questions was, are you going to take action to prevent spreading aquatic invasive species? And the first time we gave the survey, there was about a 70% positive response. And then when we gave it about 5 years later, that response had kicked up to over 90%. So that's one indication that people are at least getting the message. It doesn't tell you for sure that they're actually doing it, but they're at least aware of it.
Mr. Rendell.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, one other measure that, of course, we can't differentiate between many of our different educational methods and the watercraft inspections as to which one makes people change their behavior. So we kind of lump it all together. But one comparison between us and two other similar states, Michigan and Wisconsin, in terms of zebra mussel spread, Michigan has over 225 zebra mussel infested waters. Wisconsin has 96 currently. We have a dozen. So we feel that our efforts are very important in making a difference between us and those other states.
But Mr. Chairman, it's been moving our way. How long did it take to get to they got to their levels, and how fast is ours moving? Because we didn't have any. We had what maybe in the river and the Lake Superior, but now we're up to 12 lakes, 12 places?
Yes, we're up to about 12. They are connect. Many of them are connected, though, and that's how we're, you know, they're spreading downstream, which we can't affect that generally. But there is a time difference between those other states. Michigan did have it a few years before us, but we were exposed to it in Duluth and on the Mississippi River for many years, and we have a graph I could show you if you want to see the exact comparison year to year. But, for example, I think there's a major difference between what they did in Michigan and what we've done here. For example, the governor in Michigan once vetoed $10,000 out of the budget to put up signs at public water accesses, and that's one of the things we found from our surveys, as Steve mentioned, is one of the key ways to inform people what to do. So, you know, there's a dramatic difference in what we've done, and I think there's a pretty dramatic difference in number of infested waters, which is one measure, and it's not perfect, but it's one way to see.
Mr. Chairman, just talking again about some of the management programs, I wanted to give the example of purple loosestrife, which you remember we started a program to address that in 1987. This is one where we've actually had good success with a biological control agent, a beetle that we brought over from its native range. The beetle doesn't eliminate the loosestrife, but it keeps it in check so that it doesn't completely dominate the wetlands and marshes that it's found in. And this is an example, I think, of a very, very successful management technique that's been applied. Unfortunately, it's a bit of the exception to the rule. We've not been able to find techniques that are that effective for most of the other invasive species we have. For example, with Eurasian water milfoil, we tried to test a biological control agent or agents for that plant for years and spent a fair amount of money on research and came up unsuccessful in the final analysis in finding an effective biological control agent for Eurasian water milfoil. We do, however, have some promising herbicide applications for both Eurasian water milfoil, herbicide techniques, I should say, for Eurasian water milfoil and curly leaf pondweed, which may have some potential to provide temporary control in some waters. I wanted just to talk a little bit about terrestrial invasive species, too. We haven't talked about as much about these issues as we have aquatic invasive species, at least DNR hasn't, but they're a huge and growing issue. And if you think about the difficulty in preventing the spread of aquatic invasive species, you can multiply that by at least 1,000 when you're talking about trying to prevent the spread of terrestrial invasive species, because they don't need water as a medium to spread, and you can spread terrestrial invasive species just by driving your car down the highway. So it's a huge issue. It's a huge issue for DNR in terms of the land that we manage. We've got over 5 million acres of land, and invasive aquatic plants like buckthorn and garlic mustard are becoming an increasingly serious issue for us on these lands. We've got a very strong goal to increase our effort in this area over the next couple of years so we can more effectively manage terrestrial invasive plants. And it involves doing inventory, figuring out where we've got issues on our state lands, and then developing a management plan where we actually go out and do the control, and then also, again, research to look at developing more effective methods for control. So terrestrial invasive species is a big issue. Another aspect of the terrestrial invasive species issue that I think probably some of you have been hearing about recently is firewood. And this is another example of just a seemingly innocuous behavior of transporting firewood around that a couple of years ago nobody would have ever thought was a problem, but it's actually one of those behaviors that we have to stop doing now because it's a major vector for forest pests that are on the horizon, like the emerald ash borer and the gypsy moth, which is actually starting to make its way into the northeast part of the state.
Senator Devil.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question about these trusts, particularly the plants and the buckthorn. So I figured it might represent Southwest Minneapolis, Chamber Lakes, and the creek. We've got huge armies of citizen volunteers out trying to chop down buckthorn and all kinds of places like that. And then you go up into the neighborhoods, and there's beautiful buckthorn hedges all over the place. What are the regs with respect to these invasive exotics when they were originally brought in as cultivars? So we can't go around and chop down people's gorgeous hedges. But is there some control on bringing new plantings in, or how do we get them in?
Mr. Rendell?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, the two buckthorn species are now on the noxious weed list as restricted noxious weeds, not prohibited noxious weeds. And the reason is that there is so much buckthorn out there that if we put it on if the Department of Agriculture put it on the prohibited list, that we, for example, as the state forests would be required to control it everywhere that it exists, and which would not be very feasible or practical. So it's put on the list of the restricted ones, which prohibits its sale and transportation and propagation, essentially, but not require you to remove it like Canada thistle or other things on the regular noxious weed list. So they've tried to stop its distribution, and then also working on biological controls. Skinner over here is the lead person on that in the state, and so if there's any questions on that, perhaps to those later.
Follow-up?
Thanks. Is there any effort to educate the larger public about their beautiful hedges and the impact that might have on the lands around them that they enjoy so much and why they enjoy so much? Such property in some cases, particularly my neighborhoods, to encourage them maybe to chop down those hedges and replace them with something more appropriate?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, I would say a couple things to that. One, the very first one of these invasive species calendars that we produced and the second one each had buckthorn highlighted in there in a different month to try and raise awareness for people to remove it and manage it where it's appropriate. The other thing is that most of those efforts have been done in the Twin Cities area through community efforts. The Minneapolis Parks and Recreation has worked with the local communities on a whole community basis to try and remove it, because if you remove yours and the neighbor doesn't, as you know, that's why you're bringing this up, that it doesn't really solve the problem. So there have been I don't believe there's been any state programs to encourage that sort of community effort. There have been some grants that were issued a few years ago from federal money, I believe, but there currently is not anything that's ongoing.
Senator Pariseau.
Mr. Chairman, I can't remember which of the gentlemen at the table mentioned earlier about
I believe they mentioned the fishing moss is moving maybe a species of northerly. How far, how much of the state are you using the traps on now? Because that's the one I'm finding. And how long will the program have to be conducted before you have a grasp of it and some control? Elimination or whatever, eradication.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture.
Introduce yourself, please.
I'm sorry. Geer Friso, Minnesota Department of Agriculture, Director of Plant Protection Division. The Department of Agriculture has been trapping for a gypsy moth for over 30 years, and we set about 20,000 traps every year. Last year was our single largest gypsy moth treatment in Minnesota history. We treated 133,000 acres up and along the North Shore using a pheromone flake treatment. It is moving slowly. We've been putting out pockets of gypsy moth. There's been treatments going on for almost 20 years, so we think we've delayed the arrival of gypsy moth, set it back by that many years by the treatments. But eventually, it will come here. The main front of gypsy moth is about halfway through Wisconsin. So from natural spread, it moves forward at about 5 to 7 miles a year. And then what we have been controlling are those artificial introductions that are assisted by humans.
What are the problems with them?
I'm sorry.
Why are we concerned about gypsy moths?
Mr. Chair, the concern about gypsy moth is it's somewhat like a forest tent caterpillar, except much worse. It has a broader species component that it feeds on. It's a larger caterpillar. What it does is defoliates trees, and it's some of its favorite tree species to feed on are oaks and aspens and poplars, all of which are very abundant in Minnesota. So it will put a great deal of stress on deciduous forests once it reaches Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask a little bit more about this wood operation. I know it's just a blip in the paper. I know a lot of people at camp, a lot of them. I live in the southern part of the state. You mean to tell me that I can't take some wood and put it in my camper and drive up to some state park? You're going to stop me and tell me to take that wood out of there? How many more police are you going to have guarding that? Because that's going to upset. You better be sure you have that out there, because every station, I can take you around with me in the cities here, and there'll be wood. You can buy cords of wood. So there's a little bit more to it than just say you can't bring it in, so you better do some PR before you get to that.
Mr. Hirsch.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Vickerman, you're absolutely correct. We're aware of the potential backlash to doing something, and like I mentioned earlier, it's a very common behavior. I was just talking to a couple friends of mine this weekend, and it's complete news to them that something like that could be harmful. So we understand the PR aspects of it. But emerald ash borer in particular is a very nasty pest. It will destroy all the ash trees in an area once it becomes established, and feel like it's incumbent on us to start the education process. And one of the ways to do that is to say that you can't bring firewood that isn't from an approved source onto DNR lands. That way, especially at state parks, we can make a contact with people coming in. It becomes an educational opportunity, although you're correct, it's a potential conflict situation too, but it's just something we feel we have to do to help slow down these pests, because they're pretty serious.
Mr. Chair, one follow-up question. Okay, so I'm not allowed to do that, but I pass 15 logging trucks coming down the highway, big logs, and they can haul around. They're going to spread it just as much as some little guy sitting at a campfire in a park. I'm trying to figure out where the difference would be, because that's what I'm going to hear.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Vickerman, you're correct, and we're working on a number of fronts to try to at least address the commercial side of wood transport. But the firewood, the actual transport of firewood, particularly with bark on it, is a major vector. And not that logging can't spread it too, but the other issue is just because we stop it on DNR lands. I mean, look at all the hauling that goes on, people hauling it up to their lake. So we understand that we're just, we're not going to have a silver bullet that's going to get it all, but we really feel like we need to start the education process on this. We are a little bit ahead of the game because we don't have it here yet, and we're going to slow this down the way we've been able to slow down the gypsy moth.
So, Mr. Chair, one follow-up question. That's just on if you're going to state parks. It's not on private property that... Am I right or am I wrong?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Vickerman, that's correct. Right now we're not contemplating any legal changes that would affect people on private property, but we are going to have a big education effort to try to get people to change their behavior because it's important there, too. I don't think... I hauled a load of oak myself up to my cabin a couple years ago. I had no idea, that it was something you shouldn't do, but it's one of those behaviors that we've got to change, and it's so commonplace that we've got a big task ahead of us.
So, is there something you can do before you bring your wood up from your home to your cabin?
Can't do it.
That would alleviate an issue with this, or is just pretty much shouldn't do it?
I think the easiest message is that you shouldn't do it. It's the having the, Mr. Chairman, I understand that having the bark on increases the risk. And if you wanted to debark all your firewood, you might be able to see, the larva. But I myself wouldn't want it. I would still be concerned that it would be in.
Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, my question has been answered, but when Dutch elm disease was really raging, you could transport elm wood if you debarked it.
And the emerald ash borer that applies to all wood?
Mr. Chairman, the emerald ash borer is specific to ash, but it can attack. I'm not a tree expert, but I think there's at least five species of ash in Minnesota, and it can attack all the species of ash that we have here.
But it would be living in an oak pile of oak wood, for example, or they only live in ash?
Mr. Chairman, it is specific to ash.
Okay, that was my question.
So we shouldn't transport ash wood? Is that the message?
Mr. Chairman, for that particular pest... Go ahead, Jay.
Mr. Rendell?
Mr. Chairman, I note in the calendar that we have a firewood month, and the reason is that there are several species of insects that can be moved in firewood. So it may be emerald ash borer for in ash wood, but it could be gypsy moth or Asian longhorn beetle or something else in other wood. So that's the reason why it's a sort of a general pathway approach to firewood. It's not because of just one species.
So where's the firewood?
Senator Olson, did you have one?
Well, Mr. Chairman, that was my question about the different species, but where's the firewood month in the calendar?
February.
So Mr. Chairman, it isn't that we're just trying to deal with ash. You said that vector can transport on a variety of forms of wood, or are there different vectors that apply to different kinds of wood and you're just trying to encompass them all?
Mr. Rendell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Rendell.
Chairman, Senator Olson, there are several different species of insects that can be moved in firewood, and they each may affect different ranges of the trees. So that's why it needs to be a general approach to all firewood. Plus, it'd be very difficult for the public to differentiate whether they have oak or elm or ash or whatever in the firewood itself.
Okay, Senator Parasol.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was going to ask about, I don't know whether I should ask Mr. Rendell or maybe the gentleman from agriculture. When it comes to the emerald ash borer and you're trying to prevent its infestation as much as possible, is the Nursery Tree Association aware of anything they can do to handle it if it comes in, and is it a handleable pest from the standpoint of not losing your crop of nursery trees?
Mr. Chair, Senator, you raise a very good question. The nursery industry has been is very aware of the problem of emerald ash borer, and they have been very supportive. There is a federal quarantine in place in those, I think there's five states now that have emerald ash borer. And in those states, any ash material, including ash trees, is prohibited from moving out of those areas, including nursery stock. And in Minnesota, I think that the nursery industry, you're actually seeing a shift in tree species, what the nursery folks are growing now. They're shifting away from ash species.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks. There was some mention made earlier about approved firewood. Tell me about that. Is that, you know, what program is that? How do people find out about it? How do you find out whether or not the firewood you're buying is approved? Who approves it? All that.
Chairman, my name is Luke Skinner. I'm also with the Invasive Species Program and working on the firewood issue for the Department of Natural Resources. We're contemplating a variety of things, but we don't know exactly which ones they'll be. Steve mentioned debarking wood that's been seasoned for a certain amount of time. Dried wood, of course, you can imagine if it's been seasoned for up to two seasons, for example, nothing can survive in that. It's usually fresh wood is usually the biggest of the problems. Also, other approved woods could be woods that where you approve local dealers around state park campgrounds where they can actually buy it from approved dealer, things like that. So there's a kind of variety of things that we're still floating. And we've met with two different stakeholder meetings now, trying to get it from the recreational group as well as some of the other stakeholders about what works and what doesn't. So we're still trying to figure those out. It could be somewhere where wood is purchased or harvested within a certain distance. In Wisconsin, they don't allow firewood for more than 50 miles away from the state campground or state forest campground to be allowed into that. So they have to have it that way. There could be options down the road for actually marketing tools for having certified firewood. You know, where dealers can actually have it as something that they can market and say, hey, I have locally grown and harvested firewood that's for sale here for this region of the state. So there's lots of options and opportunities. But some of the first approved ones are obviously wood that you can buy right at the state forest campground if it's staffed. Dealers around that area that can be approved. Even dimensional lumber, you know, that's untreated dimensional lumber because it is cut and debarked already and dried. It can be burned as well. So there's four or five options that we're looking at this point.
So where does Super America and Holiday get their wood from? Is it local or is it a big national distributor?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, what we call some of the big box stores do buy it nationally, and it's really hard to know. And see, that's where working with, you know, Mr. Friso and Department of Ag, we do have to have something larger in place. For example, some companies will buy their wood. Their wood comes in from, Home Depot, comes in from Texas, yet that distributor in Texas might have bought their wood from Maine or Massachusetts or some of these quarantine states, and you don't know that, but it comes in marked from from Texas. So that's just one example of where, so we don't know. But the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the Animal Plant Health Inspection Service, has worked with what we call some of these bigger industries and starting to track down where those are and start to make those contacts with them to find out what those are. If they are coming from quarantined areas, that's illegal. So it's that interstate commerce that's being regulated by the federal government at this point.
And then where do DNR, or like registration stations at parks, they sell wood, where do they get their wood from?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, they have contracts with local growers and distributors. They ensure in the contracts that the wood has to be grown in Minnesota and cut and then packaged that way. So it has to come from Minnesota or from with a certain amount of range. And so they have individual contracts. If it's for the southeastern part of the state, the wood comes from the southeast. If it's from the northeast, it comes from the northeast. So they have separate contracts in the state with local vendors.
So those contracts ensure that they come from a close range.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
Last question, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Before I get back into the water a little bit here, questions about the DNR having a program working with lake associations to help monitor the milfoil add accesses. Do they work with that at all?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Ingebrigtsen, we do I mentioned our grant program. Roughly about $100,000 a year that we make available to local lake associations that want to treat nuisance areas of Eurasian water milfoil and Eurasian water milfoil around the axis, which is one of the major areas we feel we can treat to help it from being spread to another lake when somebody pulls their trailer out.
Follow up,
Mr. Chair. Also,
Chairman and Senator Ingebrigtsen, the interesting thing about curly leaf pondweed is it's actually been around for about 100 years. It's not new, unlike Eurasian water milfoil. The unique thing about it that gives it a competitive edge is that it sprouts up earlier in the season before the native plants, so it starts to grow. And then the problem with it is it starts to actually die off in late June and July. And when it dies off, it releases a lot of nutrients back into the water, and it can create algae blooms. It also, like Eurasian water milfoil, has a tendency to mat on the surface, so it can interfere with recreation.
Senators, next week we are going to watch episode 4, and then we're going to take up the Great Lakes Compact. I encourage you to follow up with questions after the hearing, and we have to pack it in because of the next committee hearing. But thank you very much. Committee's adjourned.